for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama reversed course on a Bush-era plan for a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. The shift reflects a revised assessment of Iran's missile capabilities. At least 25 people were killed in a suicide bomb attack in northwest Pakistan, and Indonesian police have reportedly killed one of Asia's most wanted militants. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Farah Stockman. She's foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. James Kitfield is senior correspondent at National Journal magazine. And Elise Labatt is a producer covering the State Department for CNN. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
And welcome. James Kitfield, President Obama is talking about our new missile defense structure. Outline it for us.
Well, he's basically scrapping the Bush-era plan to put a missile defense system in the Czech Republic and Poland. But unlike what some Democrats wanted, which was just to scrap that, he's offered a substitute that's actually got the backing of Secretary of Defense Gates and the Joint Chiefs, which is to move quicker with a sea-based plan based on the Aegis theater missile defense system and sort of build that from the bottom up over the next decade or so.
So the Navy would be more involved.
Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. This, again, is a theater system based on Aegis cruisers. We have that already to supply sort of missile defense coverage for our forces deployed. And he wants to build on that over the next decade to improve it, upgrade the missile interceptor. And it has the advantage of it doesn't drive the Russians quite so crazy, and he's entering arms control talk
with
them.
You're hearing a lot of pushback from Republicans saying, you know, the U.S. is caving into Russia, Farah.
Well, yeah, this system, Bush's proposal drove the Russians crazy because it put these interceptors, huge interceptors, in Russia's backyard, in what Russia considers to be its backyard. And they also had the capability to kind of see inside Russia. And so the Russians hated this, and they felt it was kind of an imposition on them and that we were encroaching on them. So a lot of Republicans are now criticizing Obama, saying he gave this concession, he didn't get anything in return. But I don't think that's a very fair way to look at it.
What do you think the U.S. might get in return?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk that, you know, Russia might be friendlier to our plans on Iran if we pull back on this missile plan. But I think other people don't see it as a concession, and they say, hey, this new Obama plan is cheaper, it's more effective, and it's more flexible, and so, you know, Russia doesn't owe us anything.
Is Iran the real backstory on this, Elise?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, right now, the Obama administration is saying that an intelligence assessment and the Defense Department and the CIA kind of determined that the long-range missile threat that the Bush administration said that this system was for was the real threat. And now the new assessment is that short-range missiles and medium-range missiles from Iran to Europe are the new threat, and this is why we have to have this system. If you look at a map of Europe and you look at the range of medium and short-range missiles for Iran, I think some of the only countries that really could be reached by these short and medium-range missiles, which are about 1,500 miles, are Ukraine and Turkey. And so if the rationale is we need to protect Europe from these missile threats from Iran, I'm not really sure that adds up. This was obviously in some ways based on science, but in some ways it was based on the fact that this was a major irritant in the relationship. Already the Russians are saying very positive things. And NATO, this missile system was not very popular with NATO. Mm. And now NATO and the Russians are all kind of saying, let's get together, let's cooperate on a missile defense shield that protects everybody. But to Farah's point about whether Russia is going to be more cooperative on Iran, you heard the foreign minister of Russia come out yesterday after the announcement of missile shield, saying, hey, we don't really think sanctions on Iran are necessary right now. So it remains to be seen whether the Obama administration is going to get its bang for its buck.
I think the backstory really is this trying to set the reset button with Russia. And I think there's two things to watch. In December, there's going to be a follow-on to the START treaty. They've been negotiating this all year. If that is successful, that'll be one sign that the relationship is at least back on some sort of a positive track. And then next year, I mean, their talks start with Iran on October 1st. If Iran sort of stiff-arms the what they call the P5 plus one, the European allies and us and Russia— if they stiff arm us, then we'll move towards sanctions. And we'll see then if Russia, if it's not an explicit quid pro quo, but we'll see if Russia is a little bit more cooperative on putting pressure on Iran.
Awful lot of demonstrations going on in the street in Iran today.
Today was Quds Day, which is an annual day in Iran for the Iranians to show their support for the Palestinian cause. Quds is the Arabic word for Jerusalem, and so everyone is encouraged to get out in the streets and demonstrate on behalf of the Palestinians. The Iran leadership, the Ayatollah Khamenei, and President Ahmadinejad warned the opposition, don't use today as an excuse to get out in the street and demonstrate on behalf of the opposition. They did so anyway. There were skirmishes between Iranian hardliners and the opposition. The former president Khatami was kind of caught up in that, and hardline forces kind of attacked him. They had to get him out of the way. There are some reports that Mosavi, the leader of the opposition, was also, there was an attempt to attack him. So the opposition did get out today in full force. It was a day of national protests. And so it's one thing to go out on a day like today. I think we have to look ahead to see whether they're going to try to use this new momentum from today to continue protesting.
And the elections are still in question, Farah?
I think that it's pretty clear that the hardliners in the Iranian government are consolidating their power. We're seeing a lot of arrests. We're seeing them clamp down. And so I think the question right now is, what will come of this? Will we see a complete squashing of the opposition over time, or will we see a new revolution? I mean, if you look back at the 1979, that took 2 years to gather and build. And so I think the U.S. officials right now are looking very carefully at what will happen next.
An awful lot of the votes that have been tallied already in this election have been thrown out, James.
Well, this election, basically, there's no international monitors in the Iranian elections. And so in this case, they basically, the votes came in a couple of hours after the polls opened. So it was clearly that it was a fraudulent election. What's interesting to me is these protests is this is just not going away. You would have thought in the past, you know, when the hardliners cracked down, pretty much they can get their ducks in a row pretty quickly because they're pretty ruthless. In this case, the opposition and the government seems very split. There's some very senior clerics who are part of this opposition. And until they sort this out, I think that our talks with them, which are going to, again, start on October 1st, are going to be very complicated because the story is out of whether this will make Ahmadinejad more sort of forthcoming because he's not feeling so stroppy because of he has all this support at home that's kind of going away from him, or whether he actually, you know, plays the nationalist card and becomes more hardline.
And even today you heard Ahmadinejad declare the Holocaust never happened.
Yeah, I was going to say that his statements today show that he's repeating these very incendiary remarks and he doesn't show signs of backing down.
And on the issue of Iran and its nuclear program, I mean, he also said in an interview yesterday that he wouldn't rule out, he said Iran doesn't need nuclear weapons, but he's not ruling out the fact that, you know, there could be nuclear weapons at some point. And when we're talking about missile defense and the eventual threat from Iran, there are some reports from the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran is moving forward with its nuclear program and also the delivery systems, which would be a missile.
No, I think that's right. And again, everything comes down to do we have enough of a international group together to cause them pressure to see a way to back down? I don't think enrichment's really on the table, but there are ways that they can keep them having enrichment, but to have much more monitoring so they don't turn that into a weapon. And I think that'll be the sort of focus of the talks.
So this focus of talks sounds to me as though it's going to be pretty broad when you finally get round to those talks, if in fact they happen. James Kitfield of National Journal, Farris Stockman of the Boston Globe, Elise Lappett, she is with CNN covering the State Department. Do join us, 800-433-8850. At least 25 people killed in a suicide bomb attack in northwest Pakistan. Elise, what do we know about this?
Well, we're still getting reports about how many casualties there were and how many civilians there were. But this is really part of the Pakistani kind of attempt to clear the area of SWAT. And this is a backlash to that. And so even though the Pakistani government has made many gains, and you saw recently there was a U.S. attack on Batala Masood, the leader of the Taliban, who was killed, even though these gains have been made, obviously the Taliban is still in full force, and this kind of offensive in SWAT and in other areas of the northwest frontier province are going to take some time to root out the Taliban.
But at the same time, earlier this week, a top al-Qaeda commander in Pakistan was said to have been killed by an American drone. Has that now been confirmed?
It's been kind of unofficially confirmed. I mean, I think they're still waiting for DNA evidence, and the U.S. government is very loath to kind of say, even though the Pakistanis will say he's dead. You know, we've said this before. Is he nearly dead or quite sincerely dead? It's like the Wizard of Oz with the Wicked Witch.
Elise Lappett, she is with CNN covering the State Department. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more talk, your calls. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup in this hour, taking a look at international stories with me, James Kitfield of National Journal, Elise Lappett of CNN, and Farris Stockman with the Boston Globe. Here's an email from Stephen in Silver Spring, Maryland. He says, what defense system? Is this the one they haven't told us about that actually works? Since Ronald Reagan initiated the Star Wars program, we've spent upwards of $20 billion with no real return. Why frustrate our friends and agitate our enemies over a system that doesn't even exist? Perhaps it's time to resurrect that old word, boondoggle. Farah.
Well, this system was, the Bush system was going to cost about $4 billion, and there were still a lot of questions about its effectiveness. And Ellen Tauscher, who was a California congresswoman, she's now Bush's undersecretary for arms control, she tried to limit spending on this last year, saying there's still too many questions about it.
So is it real or isn't it real, James?
Well, it's not real in the sense they hadn't built it yet. It was going to come online in 2018, exactly. So it was a long way from being built. It was based on the system that we have in Alaska and California. Alaska and Hawaii, I believe, California. Okay, and that system has had some successes in tests, but the critics argue the tests are very simplistic. So it is not a fully operational tested system. That's true.
All right, let's turn to Afghanistan, where President Hamid Karzai on Thursday warned Western observers not to delegitimize the results of his country's presidential election. All these elections around the world, question about them, but the fraud investigations are going on. What's the status there, James?
Well, the status is that the Afghan Electoral Commission has basically said that that Karzai won, had 54%, which is important because it avoids a runoff if you have to have more than 50%. The UN Electoral Commission, though, has found massive fraud. They've thrown out, I think, the results from 86 polling places, and they are still doing their work. So the question is, what will they say? If they throw out too many of the polling places and he could get below that 50% mark, throws it into a runoff that would probably, you know, bring a lot of chaos to Afghanistan. But again, the Americans are very worried that they're going to have an ally here who's seen as illegitimate in the eyes of his own people.
Farah.
Oh, I just think it's important to note that Peter Galbraith, who was a senior UN official, resigned, left over this. He thought a lot more of these polling stations should have been thrown out. But there are others who say, hey, look, in 2005, when the UN ran the election, there were an awful lot of fraud allegations then, too. But we didn't look very closely at them because we liked Karzai then. And I think there's a lot of Afghans who believe, you know, they're sort of shrugging their shoulders and saying, this is the same old, but now you're having trouble with Karzai, so you're closely examining these votes.
And meanwhile, the Obama administration is seeking clarity on U.S. objectives in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What do we know about those metrics, Elise?
Well, basically, the administration briefed Congress over the last few days about this series of metrics. So it's more than 50 benchmarks on how to kind of grade the progress, talking about disrupting terrorist networks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, training the Afghan forces, creating stable, accountable governments in Afghanistan free of corruption, and strengthening the Pakistani government, and then bringing all this into a kind of umbrella of international support. This is really, if you go back to the original white paper that Bruce Rydell and this kind of review came out in March, which hatched the original plan in the first place, it's going back to that original plan. And that's why you have this debate going on right now, whether there should be new troops, whether there should be new resources. A lot of people are saying, let's see about the strategy that President Obama unveiled in March. We're still ramping up there. Mm-hmm. We're putting in troops, we're putting in civilians, and we need to see if that's going to work before we think of new resources. And now they're waiting for kind of strategic assessment from General Stanley McChrystal, who's the head commander in Afghanistan, and Ambassador Eikenberry. They're expected to ask for more resources, more troops, more civilians. The administration seems very lukewarm to that right now.
I think I agree with all that. I think it's a phasing issue right now. I mean, there's going to be a request for more troops.
3,000 that Gates has said.
No, that 3,000 is already, that's going, he has authority already under current authority to send 3,000 more enablers, they call them.
Right.
But sometime this fall, the McChrystal report is the worst kept secret in town, is going to ask for more troops. Question is how many? I think he's going to ask for once 30,000 to 40,000 more troops. Whether he gets that much, I don't know. But a request will come, and I think Obama's going to be in a corner to actually grant that request because he's said Afghanistan is the center of the war on terror, et cetera. But I think he doesn't want to have this discussion right now in the middle of the health code debate. So he's going to postpone this until later in the fall. And oh, by the way, even if you ask for troops right now, they couldn't get there before the winter sets in and the fighting season slows down. So look for next spring, I think, for probably the surge.
And in the meantime, Italian President Berlusconi is saying he's pulling Italian troops out of there, Farah.
Yeah, I saw those remarks this morning. I think that, you know, Italy just lost, I think, 10 soldiers in an attack. The Italians were stationed in Herat. They were stationed in a place that traditionally didn't have a lot of fighting. And so the stomach that the Europeans don't have a lot of stomach for this war, maybe with the exception of the British. And I think that the real question right now is how long they will hang on, how long the NATO will hang on there. And if you're an Afghan and you think we're going to leave and you think that the international presence is going to just fade away, why would you support us? I think that's the real struggle that the Obama administration has right now. We're caught up in a debate about more troops or not, but there's a bigger debate there about what can we really accomplish there. Are we doing nation building or are we just doing counterterrorism? And I think that the administration hasn't quite decided the answer to that yet.
Well, that's why I was so interested in your word, James Kitfield, about these enablers. Mm-hmm. What are they supposed to be doing?
They're specialists in sort of thwarting these improvised explosives. There's a whole system of people who you can get to watch to defuse these things, to watch, monitor routes, make sure they're not laid. The highest casualty rate last month of the whole war for not only us but all the Western troops. So they're very, very intent on trying to cut that down with these enablers.
All right. Let's talk about Vice President Joe Biden's trip to Iraq, which presumably is more under control, but it sure doesn't look that way. He's in the green zone, and the bombs are dropping all around him.
Just a mile from where he was having lunch with Ramadan, kind of ending the fast with Prime Minister al-Maliki, and there were rockets that kind of landed on the American embassy compound, and that was over 2 days. It seems to be under control now. This is the third trip that Biden has made this year. He was just there as recently as July, and he's supposed to be the kind of point person in the administration to look over Iraq. And we've heard a lot, and we've talked a lot on the show about all of the security problems that Iraq has been facing in the last few months and this renewed sectarian violence. This was really a political trip. This was a message by the administration to the Iraqi leadership of two things. First of all, they're moving from this military relationship to a more strategic relationship, and they want the Iraqis to know that even though the troops are not leaving, the administration is still going to give it that cabinet-level support that it needs. And it's also, you need to get your political house in order.
Well, what about Biden's statement, if you want us to leave earlier, we will abide by your wishes?
Well, that's been the case for some time. Ever since, I think, probably 2006, we ceded that authority to the Iraqis. They can tell us to get out anytime they want. What's worrying the Americans is Prime Minister Maliki's running on his support for a referendum on maybe pushing our departure up a whole year. So, in other words, instead of getting out at the end of 2011, get out at the end of next year. And we're very worried about that. We think that that would be moving too fast, that the security situation is not stable enough. And these rockets, even while Biden was meeting in the green zone with Maliki, kind of underscore our concerns.
Farah.
Well, I just also wanted to point out that a lot of the violence is in the north and Kirkuk and Mosul. And
he talked to Kurdish leaders
right,
as well.
I think the Kurds are also, there's a lot of tension between Arabs and Kurds. And this was not a story that we were hearing a couple of years ago. But now, the Kurds have oil, and they want to develop their oil fields by giving a higher percentage of profits to these oil companies that are coming in. They want to sweeten the deal. And Maliki's people don't want to do that. So that when they give the Kurds money for their oil, they want the Kurds to take a hit, basically, to take a bigger cut out of their own money. So there's a lot. They still haven't passed the oil law, and I think that was a big agenda on Biden's big agenda item for Biden.
One of the things also on his agenda was, listen, you need to incur more foreign investment, and
right,
you need to sweeten these deals for the foreign investment that's coming in.
Right.
And so he's saying there's going to be a big conference in Washington next month on kind of incurring foreign investment, and so they really need to get that oil law in order. And they also, there's some security problems in the north. That's where, as we said, a lot of these attacks are. So the administration, it seems that they're going to take a bigger role in trying to settle these disputes between Arabs and Kurds, which are really shaping up to be the dirtiest part of the politics in Iraq right now.
And in the meantime, you've also got violence resurging in Somalia. What's going on there, James?
Well, we recently killed one of the top Al-Qaeda agents in Somalia. It was kind of interesting in that it wasn't a predator strike, a missile strike. It was actually a special forces operation where they had helicopters and they actually took his body away, which I have not seen before. But it makes the point that, you know, there's been a lot of successful hits on Al-Qaeda top guys.
Indonesia as well.
But I mean, also, in, as we said before, in Pakistan, it suggests to me that they're getting intelligence, better intelligence now than they've had, I think, in the last 8 years.
So how are these insurgents responding, though, to these hits?
There have been a couple of attacks on African Union forces, on their compound, many casualties. And it just goes to show you that you can kill the leader of one of these cells. This guy, Salih Nabhan, was considered very dangerous, but his predecessor, Aden Hashi Arroyo, was considered even worse. And now this group Al-Shabaab, that is this insurgency in Somalia, is even more dangerous than ever. And so experts don't really think that this is really going to have an effect on destroying the group. You know, there is a lot of would-be kind of commanders that could come up, and it they really think that it's going to be as dangerous as ever in Somalia. It's large swaths of the country are not governed by this transitional federal government that was appointed in 2006. And so the U.S. is very concerned that Al-Qaeda will have a safe haven there.
Farah.
Well, I mean, I think the point is that you can have these surgical strikes and you can have some successes, but the real problem there is that there's no functioning government. There hasn't been one for something like 19 years or longer. And so I think you have a lot of people who want us to get out of Afghanistan who are saying, let's just do that. Let's just do drones. But you're going to have a big I don't think Somalia shows us that there's a lot of success there.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850 to Bridgeport, Massachusetts. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, in terms as far as America, how is it that it seems nobody can wake up to this global imperial domination that is taking over? I mean, how far are we going to stray from our ancient civilization origins before anybody wakes up and realizes this is not who we are? It's not who we're meant to be.
And specifically, what are you talking about, Robert?
I'm talking about how everybody's discussing Republican, Democrat, back and forth, hee-haw-hee-haw, but nobody recognizes that it's just like the mafia. you know, you got the Capicellis, you got the Marinellis. They're going to fight back and forth.
All right. Thanks for calling, James.
Well, he cuts on a point that I have heard some analysts make, which is that, you know, policing this rather chaotic world out there is getting tougher and tougher. You know, people call it an American imperium. We have forces all around the globe trying to sort of police us a stable globe, and it's getting very, very hard to do.
Indeed. And to Cleveland, Ohio, Hiram, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Diane?
Good.
Diane, I wanted to ask your panel, and I'll give three, for the sake of time, I'll give three reasons why I think our Congress people are acting irresponsibly in regards to Afghanistan. I think first and foremost, to make the change from McKiernan to Stanley Crystal and not give him the truce that he desires to implement his strategy, which essentially is the strategy that Petraeus did in Iraq, I think it's absolutely wrong. Also, if you really look at it, the momentum is on the United States side with the Sunnis, the Indonesians, the Nigerians, the Palestinians, and several groups in Afghanistan already that are rallying and rejecting Al-Qaeda's ideology and giving intelligence, excellent intelligence, and killing a lot of their leaders and things like that. And also, thirdly, I think we have to finish the job in Afghanistan so we won't look like we did in Iraq in 91 when we didn't finish the job and had to go back. And then if we don't do it this time, it's going to be a springboard for Al-Qaeda to launch another 9/11 attack and so forth and so on. And
all right. Thanks for calling. Farah.
Well, I think the caller makes an interesting point. She said we have to finish the job in Afghanistan, and she made the analogy with Iraq, but you can make the analogy with Afghanistan itself. I mean, we were there in the 80s, and we left, and a lot of people say, hey, we abandoned that country then. We left them to civil war, and 9/11 was sort of some blowback from that. And so I think that there are many in the administration who would agree with the caller and say that if we left Afghanistan now, it would descend into civil war and become a problem that we would have to come back and solve at an even higher expense later.
And I also think about the point that we were talking about earlier is we have to really figure out what our job is. Is it to feed al-Qaeda? Is it to nation build, as Farrell was saying before? And so I think the debate right now within Congress about more troops, and we've heard comparisons to Afghanistan, and we don't want to get bogged down right now, is what are we really trying to achieve? If you look at this list of metrics that the administration is putting out, these are very lofty goals. You know, combat extremism while corruption, while supporting human rights. That sounds a little bit like nation building to me. And that's going to take a really long-term commitment. And there are many that say that the U.S., you know, as we were saying, is a superpower, is needed all around the world for threats that are against the United States. So I think that's why there's so much debate going on about what we really should be doing in Afghanistan.
Elise Labatt, she covers the State Department for CNN. Farrah Stockman of the Boston Globe, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. More of your calls, your email, your tweets, and messages from Facebook when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with comedy writer Larry Gelbart. He died last week at age 81. Gelbart developed the TV series MASH, worked on Sid Caesar's Show, and co-wrote the book for the Broadway hit A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's an email from Reza in New York who says, why would Iran, a nation that's been around for 3,000 years, want to commit suicide by attacking the U.S., therefore NATO and Israel, with a few non-existent nukes and missiles when the U.S. and Israel can retaliate with 10,000-plus nukes? This all sounds like the run-up to the invasion of Iraq when the U.S. and Israel cooked up all sorts of lies. James?
Well, I take that point. I think that Iran is a rational actor on the world stage, and it tends to try to stay just below a red line that would cause us to retaliate. Clearly, a missile strike from Iran would invite massive retaliation from us or from Israel. And for that reason, I think a lot of people think that Iran, even if it got nuclear weapons, could be contained. You would have to make very explicit that what would happen to them if they ever threatened to use or use those weapons.
And here's another perspective sent from Nima, who's in San Antonio, Texas, who says, what point is there in establishing diplomatic ties with Iran if we have no advantageous leverage? Russia's not on board. Neither is China supportive of any sanctions. And we can't even apprehend their Minister of Defense, who's an Interpol fugitive. Do you all know that?
Okay. Yes, the administration isn't thrilled with that.
All right. How do you even talk to a regime that has had death to America as its national slogan for 30 years? Farah.
Well, I think there is a possibility here that simply putting it on the table, simply saying, hey, the United States is willing to talk to Iran now, can neutralize sort of the idea of the American boogeyman in Iran. And it can actually give the administration more power. Up until this point, any democratic activist in Iran who spoke out against the regime was tied to the United States, was a puppet of Western powers. And the more that Western powers say, hey, we're willing to sit down with you, Iran, the more the regime can't have that us and them set up in the same way. I think it's actually quite clever because it can really show, it can flush out the extremists, and it can really show the radicals in Iran for the unreasonable people that they are.
James.
And we actually have talked to Iran. You know, a lot of people don't remember, but just after we invaded Afghanistan, there were high-level talks with Ambassador Crocker, a former ambassador in Iraq. He had high-level talks with the Iranians, and they were pretty supportive of what we were doing in Afghanistan because they were no friends of the Taliban. So, and remember, Reagan administration and the Iran-Contra deal had high-level talks with them. So it's not like we can't talk with Iran. Yes, they like to, you know, trot out the death to America to build up nationalist sentiment. But they're, like I said, they're a rational actor on the world stage in many ways. And if they see their interests in talks, they'll talk.
Here's a message from Evelina on Facebook. She says, I'd like to hear what success would look like in Afghanistan. It's hard to reach a goal that you haven't really defined, Elise.
Well, that's why the whole issue right now that they're going on and defining the mission, defining the strategy, and that's why you've heard cabinet secretaries and their aides, like Secretary of State Clinton, say they need this mission more clearly defined. I think what would be defined as success in Afghanistan is if you have a government that's strong, that can deliver services to its people, deliver security to its people, that has a functioning army, that's not as strife with corruption as it is, and is willing to kind of work to get rid of these terrorist networks. But I think the greater problem right now, and we were talking earlier during the break, is Pakistan. That's where the biggest threat to the United States is. That's where Al-Qaeda is believed to have the strongest network. That's where Osama bin Laden is believed to be hanging out right now. And so success in Afghanistan doesn't necessarily mean success in Pakistan. In fact, as we put more troops into the south, there's a fear that more Taliban will go across the border into Pakistan, and there'll be even more kind of terrorist activity there.
Let's go now to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Lee.
Hi, good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me on.
Surely.
I listen to your show every day.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your insight and your guests on your show. My original comment was going to be commenting on the success in Afghanistan as well. You know, how can you define success when these young men, basically young men who are growing up there, have seen their families blown away, they have nothing to live for, and this is why Al-Qaeda and all the other extremist groups seem to be getting, people wanting to be in Al-Qaeda and be extremists because they actually have nothing to live for. You know, it's as though the United States and the big G8 have defined the world scene and said, listen, we have the right to the pursuit of happiness. We seek our own validation. You have no validation. So my idea is that we should give these people something to live for. Don't send drones over and just wipe out families and innocent people while you're trying to get the Al-Qaeda people at the same time. I mean, this just creates more and more hate and fear. And just as we have our own version of what we think it is over there, they have their own version, too, of who they think we are.
James.
Well, she had an interesting phrase in there, give them something to live for. That is very much part of the strategy. It's why you're trying to build a government that can supply services and education to the people of Afghanistan. And the fear is if you just pull out or if you just, you know, build Afghan security forces, you're never going to win the populace to the side of the Afghan government and to our side. And so I think that's part of the strategy. And, you know, the they've had experience with the Taliban. The Taliban are not that popular. So I think a lot of people think that this is doable. But you do have to, you know, do you have that kind of nation building to give them something to live for?
Farah.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the early days of after the U.S. Mission in Afghanistan, 2002. People had a lot of hope there. They were very excited about us being there. And people wanted schools. They wanted jobs. And they, you know, entrepreneurs came there. That people started businesses. And so I think now what you're seeing in the population is a hopelessness because this violence continues to drag on. So I think success is simply the absence of violence. And I think Afghans themselves would define success as just the ability to live in peace.
And to walk in the street, to go to a grocery store or a restaurant without the fear of being hit.
And I think right now the problem is that both U.S. troops and the Taliban are marring that vision of hope, because the more troops you put there, the more the violence there is, because there's more targets.
Let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, Wayne. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
My problem with it is it's going to take a lot of time in Afghanistan to do what you're talking about, doing nation building, and we don't have that much time. We've only got years, or probably not even that long, when we're going to restrict ourselves on the rules of engagement, and innocent people are going to get hurt, and we're going to cry about it. I just can't see how we can win it. I think we ought to cut our losses and get
Elise.
Well, one of the problems with this whole political and election issue is that it's taking a very long time to resolve, and there's a lot of political uncertainty in the country. There's not going to be a leader maybe till the spring before this all shakes out. And if the administration is saying it has about a year for progress, then the clock is really ticking. One of the things, when the previous caller was talking about the issue of hopelessness, one of the reasons that the U.S. is working with the Afghan government right now to try and integrate the Taliban, to give them some sense of hope so that they are not turning to extremism. And there's a very ambitious program right now to get tribal elders in the country to support these Taliban and reintegrate them and to give them hope and create jobs for them. There's also the issue of the drug interdiction and giving farmers hope by creating this very big, there's a lot of U.S. officials from the Agriculture Department right now really trying to create these little pockets of hope throughout the country.
But Wayne is saying he thinks we ought to cut our losses and quit. Farah?
Well, I think he's very much right that in order for success to come about in Afghanistan, it is going to take time. I think he's absolutely right about that, and I think he's right that patience is running out. But I think the administration wants to at least bend the trajectory towards the positive. If they can prove that, hey, there's less violence, there's it's costing less, if they can show some metrics of progress, then they're hoping that people will be able to hang on and be patient. I think, you know, the other thing the caller should recognize, though, is if we just up and leave Afghanistan right now, what does that do to our prestige in the world? What does that do to NATO's? We're basically sending the message that NATO and the United States, the world superpower, cannot keep its promises to the poorest country in the world.
But what would happen in Afghanistan if we simply cut and ran, James?
Well, if we cut and run now, the Taliban will come back to power. They're already in 80% of the country. There's no question whatsoever that the Afghan government and the Afghan security forces would be overrun by the Taliban. And then you just have to look at what happened when the Taliban were there last time. It would force Pakistan. It would tell all the people, the hardliners in Pakistan who said they're Americans are going to cut and run, so let's have a deal with the Taliban, because that's our sort of proxy in Afghanistan. Those people would be ascendant in Pakistan, and so their repercussions are potentially quite strong. But I take the listener's point. We probably have a year of this, and look, and the strategy is the Iraqi surge. I mean, look, That is what they're hoping for. With 40,000 or however many more troops, you can buy enough goodness to buy you time to build the Afghan security forces. And within a couple of years to 3 years, you can hand off most of the responsibility for the fighting and dying, unfortunately, to the Afghan security forces and slowly start to pull out.
Do you think that there is a consensus on that belief?
There's a consensus on that belief within the administration, I think. Within the administration and at the Pentagon. Like that's the strategy they're following. That's going to be what McChrystal's going to recommend. But they know that if they deploy these forces and things don't get better, then this guy's right. This is probably going to be a losing war, and within a year we'll be thinking about cutting it off.
Farah.
I actually think it'll be worse than the Taliban, because this is not one group that's taking over. This is not the Taliban led by Mullah Omar. Thousands of different armed groups that call themselves the Taliban. This is not your daddy's Taliban. This is a loosely armed, confederated, armed groups, and they'd be fighting a civil war all over the place. I don't think they have the discipline that the original Taliban did. I don't think they have the cohesiveness. So I think you'd have a civil war in a lot of different places.
And also, we're talking so much about the Taliban, but initially when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001, it wasn't the Taliban necessarily, but it was going after Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda still has very strong roots in that area. So if you're talking about why would we stay, it's the biggest threat to the United States, is still Al-Qaeda, and the U.S. says it needs to stay there, yes, to destroy the Taliban, but mostly so that they don't give safe haven to Al-Qaeda to plan attacks against the United States.
And having been in Europe recently and done a story on some thwarted plots from terrorist plots in Europe, every major plot that they thwart has ties back to the Pakistani tribal regions. Mm-hmm. They have facilitators there who they are training again, who are sending out on these plots. And it gives you the idea of what would happen if they had more leeway.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show and to Alex in Tampa, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you? I'm calling to say that I think too much is made out of this decision to abort the project in Poland and Czech Republic before it started. It was simply a mistake by the United States. It has proven to be a mistake. It's produced nothing but Topol 4, most powerful, most destructive nuclear weapons in response to this idea even. Divided Europe. It's an increased number of people in Russia who think that Russia should have its own defenses, and it would have been very ineffective even when it would be materialized.
Yes, so, we had one email that says, why should the United States be putting these missiles in defense of Europe? Can they not do their own defending?
Well, no, they can't do their own defending. It's why we have the NATO alliance that ties us into the defense of Europe. But he's quite right that, the missile defense system was not that popular with the publics either in Poland or the Czech Republic.
Right.
They saw it as bringing probably more trouble from the Russians than it was worth. It was really the political elites in those countries that were anxious to do it.
All right. And finally, let's go to Clara in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am calling to, I was reading about the Iraqi journalist who had thrown shoes at President Bush and her comments he made when he was freed, which I thought were very touching and powerful, although I don't condone his behavior. He said, the invasion divided brothers and neighbors and turned our houses into places for endless mourning, and our streets and parks into cemeteries. Shame was chasing me like an ugly name for my helplessness. I thought, well, that was pretty, powerful and touching.
Pretty powerful statement, Farah.
I'm sure he speaks for a lot of Iraqis when he says that. I just wanted to mention that this morning there was a report that a guy in Anbar threw a sandal at a passing U.S. military convoy, and they thought it was a grenade, and they shot back. But he didn't. He wasn't killed. But I think that this is a very, I think this whole experience is going to haunt Iraqis for a very long time.
It's a traumatized society. It's been a traumatic 7 years. A lot of Iraqis don't appreciate the, I don't think a lot of people, except for the hardcore Baathists, miss Saddam Hussein, but they've been through a horrific period, lots of bloodshed, and that's going to leave lasting scars.
I think that the invasion kind of, that was the one thing. You've had these sectarian divides that have been lingering. You know, Saddam Hussein was kind of the thing that kept them all, you know, all those tensions kind of boiling. But they've been boiling for years. And the one thing that they all agreed on was the occupation needed to end. And so that's why the one hope right now is that the Iraqis can settle their political differences and move forward on a nationalist Iraqi strategy for moving their country in the post-Saddam Hussein era.
Well, there is always hope. Elise Labatt, she covers the State Department for CNN, James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine, Farrah Stockman of the Boston Globe. Have a good weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.